Welcome to episode 148 of the Geek Dads podcast. This is Will James, one of the writers here at Geek Dad. This podcast is a recording I made of a one-on-one panel I did with John Kovalik this past weekend at the Southern Fried Gaming Expo in Atlanta. It's a great con that focuses on modern and retro arcade games, consoles, and new this year, a huge tabletop area, which is why we had John there as one of our special guests. I highly recommend checking out Southern Fried Gaming Expo next year. It's going to be even bigger and better than it was this year. I hope you enjoy the conversation I had with John as much as I did. Thanks for listening.
Geek Dad.
This is from Dork Tower to Munchkin with John Kovalik. I don't know how much introduction he needs for people who are here, but Dork Tower, Munchkin. Yeah.
Zero to none in 60 seconds.
And you probably don't care very much, but I'm Will, and I'm a writer at Geek Dad, and I'm the tabletop gaming coordinator here at the Expo.
Whoa!
That's okay. Pity clapping isn't all that great. So I wanted to start off by telling you that in high school I was a big Dungeons & Dragons guy, and then after high school I went away to college and I kind of stopped playing tabletop games for quite a long time, and my wife took me to a New Year's Eve party right after we met, and their friends broke out Munchkin, and we played Munchkin through the New Year, and ever since then we've been playing tabletop games like crazy. I have a fancy, you know, gaming table in my living room and everything, so that's thanks to you.
Oh, thank you.
So to start off, I wanted to ask, when and how did you first get into gaming?
Okay. The long and the short of it is I started when I was in school in England. The first inklings of it, I actually went to school in the Midlands in a school called Neville Holt, which was actually the ancestral family home of the Neville family. If anybody's ever played Kingmaker, it's actually a piece on the board, and I went to school on that piece. And as a British schoolboy, you just play with these little Airfix 1/72 figures, plastic figures. The Desert War, you know, Rommel versus Montgomery. And very soon after that, we discovered that some people were putting out rules for playing with these soldiers. So historical wargaming is very big, was always very big in England. And there were clubs all over the place. And I started, you know, it combined my hobbies of painting these figures, of making model tanks, painting, and actually getting rule sets to tell you what happens when you put one toy tank up against another. And this would eventually become my job, in a sense. But yeah, so this was back in the early 1970s. And one thing led to another. You would find, by word of mouth, through gaming clubs. Gaming clubs in England would often be located at pubs. So to this day, I actually associate the smell of stale beer with gaming. And there are worse smells to associate with gaming, quite frankly. But from there, I was in a model shop in Bristol, England, and just looking for some more toy tanks. And I saw a bunch of war games. SPI was an old war game manufacturer, and I pulled one of them down off the shelf, and it was kind of a clamshell game. It was called Panzer 44. In the top right hand corner was this little thing saying the time is 0800 hours, December 23rd, 1944. And they had me just at that little thing. It was a giant picture. I think it was a Tiger tank just staring you down. And just that shot off all these little gaming neurons in my body. And so that was the very first board game, actually, I played. Although in England at the time, there was a very good Main Street game, you know, you call it a big box game, Escape from Colditz, which we played a lot of as kids. And they're actually coming out with a 50th anniversary edition of this. And that makes me unnaturally excited. But it was a very, very tense little board game. So you know, it's certainly a few steps above things like the Happy Days game or what have you. So I started getting into these board games as well. And we started looking for other game stores around the country. And in London, there's a game store in Hammersmith, which is one of the outlying boroughs of London. And this was called Games Workshop. And at the time, Games Workshop was just another game store. So we would go there and buy figures, buy board games. And one day, I noticed they had a small little white box that said Dungeons & Dragons on it. And the artwork in this was horrible. it was three small booklets that came in this box. And this was actually the second iteration of Dungeons & Dragons. They published a brown box version first. It was full of typos. It was very badly laid out. But somebody had taken the time to photocopy a page that said, "What is role-playing?" And there's a little dungeon printed up next to it. And there was, you see these now in pretty much every role-playing game you buy, a little dialogue between the game master and the players. I do this, I do this. And again, just much like that first SPI game, just everything, every neuron went off. It was like, oh my goodness, this is something totally new. This is so cool. This is wonderful. And so from there, yeah, I went into role-playing. And my college years were mostly spent playing the game Traveller, which I loved. I absolutely adored that. If you're not familiar with Traveller, it is a role-playing game where you can actually die during character generation. And I think this is actually the most misunderstood and most abused rule out there because I love this. It just made character generation actually have consequences and actually have risk involved. I thought this was tremendous. And yeah, from there, everything sort of took off. Went to college, just started playing a lot of board games. Cosmic Encounter was one of the first ones I remember, which was so ahead of its time. I mean, it would just fit. I mean, it fits in nicely with so many games these days. And you can really see, obviously, it was a precursor to Magic the Gathering, but, you know, also just general Euro-style games. I fell out of it a little bit during college. Then I got back into it soon afterwards, and yeah, just it's ingrained. Sorry that answer took so long.
No, it's great.
In the time that answer went out there, you could have finished any of those games I talked about.
So this just occurred to me. Speaking of beer and games, so have you heard of Drinking Quest?
I have heard of this, mostly because they still owe me a game from their Kickstarter.
Well, he's here.
Excellent!
So you can get it from him. And we're doing a live Drinking Quest game tomorrow on stage. And we still have spots open, so if you want to join us...
The woman shaking her head in the back row is my wife.
At the very least, you can go get your copy of the game from
her. I hear maybe. We'll see.
Offer's open.
That's true.
It's a one drink game. So, just a beer. Just a beer. We're going to have audience participation too, though. So, we're going to have anybody who brings a drink can bet on a certain player and have to drink with that player. So, you guys should come. It'll be fun.
For the radio audience at home, I'm giving the thumbs up.
So, I was going to ask you whether art or gaming came first, but it sounds like gaming came much sooner.
No, actually, bad art came first. It was definitely art. My mom was a cartoonist. She was an editor for a kids publication here in the States called My Weekly Reader, and she wrote a comic strip for this called Hops the Bunny. And so she developed a shorthand style of drawing so that she could tell the cartoonist what should be going on in each panel. And so my mom was always drawing, and I just picked up drawing after her. I thought it was really cool and really fun. I was a very, very poor artist, but it was still very enjoyable. And I've actually got back at home some of the original Hops cartoons framed up on the wall from, you know, boy, some of those would be late 60s, I think, something like that.
Does she look anything like Officer Hops from Zootopia? That sounds awfully similar. I think Disney might owe her some royalties.
You think Hops looks... Okay, I'm talking to my daughter here. You don't think Hops looks the same? Okay. We're taking it from the expert
okay,
here.
Okay, yeah. All right.
By the way, it's like, you know, Hops for the name of a rabbit. Yeah, boy, I mean, what else are the rabbits called? You know, none of them are called, I don't know, Schwarzenegger or anything like that. It's
Bruno. That's a good rabbit name. Speaking of your art, is there anything you can tell us about the 16:9 sketch you teased about yesterday?
No. It's a project I'm working on. It will probably see light, but I absolutely cannot talk about it. But it's really fun.
If anybody didn't see it, you should go look at Facebook.
Yeah, I put up some pencil sketches of the characters in a couple of locations, and the ratio of these drawings was 16:9. That may mean something to some folks here, but I'm not allowed to talk about it. It's really fun, though. It's hugely fun. I'm actually taking a lot more time. I've been turning down a lot of projects recently because I've just been feeling a little bit divorced from my own work. And the last couple of months, I actually turned down a couple of conventions, one in England and one in Kosovo. And I just need to be home working a little bit. And it's been a really fun few months just getting back to my own stuff. And Dork Tower has been going up on the website more regularly. I've been blogging a little more regularly. I've been working on a couple of secret projects, which is really fun and cool. And I've been home with my daughter a lot more, which has also been very cool.
Which leads to another question I was going to ask, and it's even better that she's here. Do you do a lot of gaming with your family, specifically your daughter?
Louisa likes being the judge in games like Apples to Apples a lot. That was the first game she really grew to enjoy. Now she wants me to teach her Pokemon, which means I've got to learn Pokemon. And she's also into Yo-Kai Watch. So
Yo-Kai Watch Life.
Yes, yes. So I bought her the Game of Life Yo-Kai Watch version. But Louisa's also made her own games. So she's actually designed a couple of board games on her own that we play.
Awesome.
The rules do tend to change from time to time, but for the most part, they're excellent fun games.
Although we lost one of them because I bought a box cover, but then we couldn't find it.
We'll find it. It's not only misplaced. It's not lost.
It was Time Travel Delia.
That's right. She made a time travel game, and this is with no knowledge of Doctor Who at all.
Awesome. So, budding game designer over there.
Yes.
Awesome. Do you have any games that are your favorite that you actually take out and play or that inspire you in your art or game making?
I love so many games, and it changes from year to year. A few years ago, I was absolutely obsessed with a lot of the cooperative games out there. It started off with Forbidden Island. And Jonathan from Geek Dad taught that to us at a maker fair a few years ago. And it's one of these games which you just get really caught up in it. I mean, if you've not played it, do go out and play it. But I think most people here have probably played it. There's this real palpable sense once the island starts sinking and time starts running out. And I love that. I'd never played any game quite like that. And so Castle Panic was another favorite. And there were a couple of other games in that rotation. And then the following year, the games I was obsessed with were Camel Up and Cold Express, which are really terrific, easy entry games, but there's so much game to them. It's just wonderful. Cold Express has been described as Robo Rally for people who hate Robo Rally. And Camel Up is just one of the nicest designs I've ever seen. It's just a wonderful camel racing game, but you're actually not racing the camels. You're betting on the camels. And you can bet on the camels to come first or to come last or to win a certain leg or, you know, various other things. And it's got this really ingenious device. The pyramid will roll the dice for you. It will only let one die out of the pyramid at a time. And that color die moves a certain color camel. So that's a wonderful, wonderful game. Then for a while, I was obsessed with some games that I just didn't get. I mean, I loved the games. I couldn't understand what strategies were behind them, what you needed to win. And those would be games like King of Tokyo and Small World. I mean, I can play Small World a dozen times, and I will win some of them, but I will never figure out what it did to make me win that game. I still love it. So yeah, it definitely changes. Right now, like most of the gaming world, I love Codenames. And Codenames is just a wonderful, wonderful game. And, you know, I'm thinking I want to try playing it using Dixit cards. Mm. It was funny. A couple of years ago at Gen Con, I was doing a signing for Asmodee because I had just illustrated the game Cash and Guns. And I love this game so much. I actually, when they approached me, I was too busy. I didn't want to do the art for this game, but I wanted a copy of the game. So I said, sure, send me a copy and I'll try it out. And, you know, the full idea was that I would get a copy of the game and I could pass the job off to somebody else. And one Christmas morning, we started playing Cash and Guns around the Christmas table, and the grandparents were appalled, but it was so freaking fun. I just had to do this. So anyway, I illustrated Cash and Guns, and I love that game so much. But I was doing a signing at Asmodee, and next to me also signing was Richard Borg, who has designed many games, and has designed one of my favorite games, Memoir 44, which is it's a terrific war game, very clever mechanics, and it really just feels like an old school war game, board game, but the mechanics are just beautiful, very elegant. And it's just the two of us at a table doing a signing. And after a while, he looks at me and he says, so, do you actually play games? And I sort of went, oh, you have no idea. It's, tons. Favorites are always, always changing. I think Ticket to Ride, I always go back to. I love Ticket to Ride. Carcassonne is one I'll always go back to. I don't play too much Munchkin because I always lose. Okay, Munchkin's 15 years old this year. I've won 2 games of Munchkin that whole time. And I'm not trying to lose. I'm trying to win. The low point was when I was at a convention in Ireland, WarpCon, and they left the blank cards in. And if I got a blank card, I was allowed to draw it and, you know, help myself. And the reason why I will never be a great Munchkin player is because any Munchkin player given that opportunity would draw a card that says John wins or I win or something like that. And I just could not pull that trigger. But yeah, I won two games in 15 years. The first game came about the 11-year mark because I was playing an orc and nobody noticed that I had just killed a level 2 monster, which gives the orc an extra level. And the second win was actually against the Polish national champion, because for the first freaking time, everybody else at the table was gunning for him and not me. I mean, everybody guns for me when I'm playing Munchkin with other people because they think I've got some insight into how Munchkin is played, you know, what the game is like. It's like, no, I just do the cards. Pick on somebody your own size. He took all of the flack, and I was able to sneak out a victory. And he had just won the Polish national championship that morning, so that actually felt pretty good.
That's awesome. Besides art and gaming, what would you consider yourself to be a geek about?
Oh, everything across the board. The geekdom is very broad. It could be Star Wars. It could be cheese. Yes, I'm definitely a cheese geek. It could be painting. It could be pens. You know, which I suppose goes with the art. But you know, I really. Yeah, it's just too broad. I mean, I really glom onto things. There's nothing I'm really obsessed with more so than anything else. Possibly cooking, I would say. Once gaming and cartooning went from being my hobbies to being my job, I think cooking became my hobby then, and there's no fear of that ever becoming a profession. Music, big music geek. Huge music geek. I used to be a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And I just wrote a lot of music articles, went to see a lot of bands, interviewed Paul McCartney. Actually, I didn't interview Paul. I was in the room as other people interviewed Paul McCartney. I was too scared to speak. Paul and Linda were sitting about where you guys are in relationship to me, and I'm just sitting there with my jaw on the floor going, oh my gosh, I'm in the same room as a freaking Beatle. And all these other reporters are asking what I'm thinking are like some of the stupidest questions I've ever heard. And I couldn't say a word. I cannot criticize them. I was just sitting there. It's like, God, it's Paul McCartney. Holy cow. I'm moderating my language here because we got, you know, my daughter here. But, I would say music is probably the third great passion of mine. Then cooking after that.
And for those who can't see, John has five different pens in front of him, so
yes,
that proves his pen.
It's taken me so long to find the right pens, and I'm just never. A lot of people will ask, why don't you just use a Wacom tablet? It's like, no, it's taken me this long. Also, I just like the feel of pens and paper, and I like having, you know, finished Munchkin drawings at the end of it, or Dork Tower drawings. I like holding up a piece of paper with something on it. The computer's going to give you a perfect line, and I do envy that. I love the folks who know how to use that really well, but I just like holding up an original. It's I like looking at originals. There was a traveling Schultz exhibit which came through Chicago, and we made a special trip down there to go to the Art Institute to see the Schultz exhibit, and it was actually held in the kids section of the Art Institute. And I was just there staring at these original Schultz drawings, just looking at the line work, looking at how beautiful this was. And, you know, little five-year-olds are staring at me going, who's the odd person there? So, what's wrong with that man, Mommy?
So, speaking of drawing, what do you like doing better, working on games or working on the comic?
Oh, that's tough. Probably the comic, because I'm also telling a story with the comic, so you've got that added dimension to it. You know, it's not just the art for the drawing's sake. You know, whether it's a comic book or a four-panel comic strip or something like that. And that's one of the things I've really been missing over the last few years, is working on longer-form stories with the comic book. But, you know, Munchkin is so great to work on. I love trying to make Munchkin better every single release. And part of that is because I'm not happy with the art for the original Munchkin. And Steve knows this, and Steve refuses to let me redraw it. He says that some of those things have become iconic now. But I look at that original Munchkin box and I see every mistake in it. I mean, I was using horrible pens at the time and horrible paper. And if you look really closely, you can see there's like a lot of line bleed. I mean, honestly, I was using Sharpies at that point in time just because it was fast and it was quick and I could Like so much Munchkin, the deadline was really short, really tight, and I had to crank out 156 cards, 162, whatever it was, in a very short period of time. And I was just drawing. And after a few years, I started really finding out about much better pens. So once you get up to Munchkin, probably Cthulhu, I think that might be when I started using really much better materials. And so I'm much happier with that. Especially if I get to do like a lot of, if I get a lot of time for a cover, something like the Munchkin Pathfinder cover or a Kobold Saint My Baby, a large piece like that. I love getting lost in something like that and just really trying to do the very best work I can, whatever that level that might be at the time. But yeah, the storytelling aspect with Dork Tower or with Dr. Blink brings something else in entirely, and I just really love that. I like trying to craft a 4-panel joke. I like trying to craft a 20-page story. I did recently. I'm really getting the bug again. I did a backup for the Munchkin comic book, which is actually the issue on the stands now. It's a 6-page piece. And I did the Munchkin Fu Mikado. So it combined my love of Gilbert and Sullivan with Munchkin for probably the most obscure comic you're ever going to read this year. I really enjoyed working in that longer form.
Do you have a favorite edition of Munchkin?
It's usually the last one I worked on. And the least favorite is usually the one I worked on 2 years ago. I love... There's sort of a very odd curve of my level of satisfaction with my work. I have a really good, fun time with it. Then once it's done, I get the sinking feeling that, oh my gosh, I could have done better. If I just had a little more time, it's like, oh man. And then I don't want to look at it again because it's just going to depress me. And then the game comes out and I go through the game and it's like, oh, okay, that wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And so I'm happy with it for probably 6 months to a year and a half. And after about a year and a half, I'm like trying new techniques, new things. And I look back, it's like, oh gosh, I used to think that was good. What was wrong with me? It's a very odd sort of thing, I suppose. I'm happy with where my art is at the moment, but I always want it to be better, and I always want to try to make it better. And again, it goes back to seeing every single mistake, and my gosh, the mistakes will just leap out at me. Hey. My favorite days, I gotta say, sometimes I will take Louisa to my studio. And we all have daddy-daughter drawing days. And those are fantastic. Those are just the best times ever.
One time we made my mama a Mother's Day present.
That's right. It was so fun. So, yeah, it is, I mean, my favorite times ever drawing is when Luis is there drawing with me.
So you mentioned that you have two secret projects that you're working on. Are there any projects that are in the works that you can talk about? Only secret ones right now?
I like the way you assume there's only two secret ones.
You said there are two secret ones.
Yes, there are
probably other ones.
Wow, right now, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I'm working on a game the Munchkin stuff I can never talk about. Because Munchkin is so far in advance. Phil Reed just emailed some really good news today about a Munchkin project I'd completely forgotten about. Because I finished it early this year, late last year, and I hadn't heard anything about it since. And it was totally off my radar. It's like, oh, okay, so there's good news about that. And yeah, Munchkin is really right now its own machine. It's a very well-oiled machine. But yeah, I can never talk about it. I would like to post more pictures as I'm drawing Munchkin to Twitter or to Facebook or wherever. I'm working on a game with Cool Mini or Not, which is really going to be fun. And I cannot say what that game is, but I can say that it is going to be a really incredibly cool game. I'm working.
And it will have minis.
Was it?
I'm sure it will have minis.
Yes, it will have minis. They did a great job with some Dork Tower Zombicide figures, and I was just incredibly impressed with how well they got the Dork Tower characters to go into 3D. Hold on a second.
No problem.
What's that? Louisa would just like to say something about Cash and Guns at the moment.
Okay.
Okay.
One time.
Let me speak in the microphone.
One time when we were playing Cash and Guns, Emma, my cousin, she got out, and then I gave her a hospital card to get her back in the game.
Yes, Louisa is a very sweet gamer. She should never play Munchkin. You're much too sweet for Munchkin, honey. You gotta be very cutthroat for Munchkin. Stripey could play Munchkin.
Yes.
Oh, Stripey is not very nice.
Stripey's Louisa's favorite stuffy, and Stripey used to be a much naughtier kitty, but apparently going to cat school helped a lot. So Stripey's pretty well behaved these days. But yeah, boy, Stripey used to get in all kinds of trouble.
One thing did happen to Stripey.
What was that?
When I was at my cousin's house.
Yeah?
He asked for Stripey's paw.
Yes.
And then he put a green stamp on it.
Oh.
It's really hard to see, but it's still there. It's like right here on his paw.
Yep, I see it.
Little green stain.
I'm sorry, we were
talking about the Cool Mini or Not game.
Oh, yeah, there's the Cool Mini or Not game. Oh, boy, this is where I wish I brought one of my other notebooks along. I've got, the big thing is I'm working up towards a Kickstarter. This has not really been announced yet, but I think I've dropped enough hints. There's going to be a Kickstarter. I'm hoping it will be in August, and this would be for a new Dork Tower collection. I really miss doing the long story. And also, when I stopped self-publishing 8 years ago, I left one storyline kind of dangling. It's just like, oh, come on, couldn't I have just published that one other issue and wrapped that up? I'm very excited about that. Let me think. What can I talk about? There's always more Kobolds Ate My Baby stuff. There's the Kobolds Ate My Baby card game, Knuckle Sandwich, is being kickstarted at the moment. And I love drawing kobolds. Kobolds are probably some of my favorite pieces of graphic design. I just love how they turned out, and I have a huge amount of fun drawing them. This is the 15th anniversary of Munchkin, so I do have out now, I'm a guest artist as part of the guest artist series, because I did not draw Munchkin Foo. My friend Greg Hyland drew Munchkin Foo back in the day because I was just too busy. I had another Munchkin project and a Shea Geek project. I finally got my chance to draw Munchkin Foo, and that is out now. There are Munchkin Meeples that just came out, which are delightful. Oh, there's a Munchkin collectible card game. I can't talk about that. Because that was... Oh, double feature, of course. Thank you, wife of mine. So I actually have been designing some games. I did a game called Raffle, a party game. And some friends of mine in Madison... And I do this game called Double Feature, which is, I love this game so much. It is a movie game, but it's not a movie trivia game. It's an actual card game with actual gameplay. You're trying to link two cards by yelling out a movie, which contains the features on both cards. Like, the movie's in black and white, the movie's a comedy. The movie is a buddy movie. The title is at least five words long. So the first person who can yell out the name of any movie that links those two gets one of the cards as a point. The other card stays on the table, and then a new card is turned over. And I'm really not one, you may have noticed this, to go on about loving my own work. But really, it was the other guys who came up with the basic concept of this, and I've just been helping along with it. It's a wonderful game. It is my favorite movie game by far. It's not a trivia game. You don't have to know who directed Porky's 3 to move four spaces ahead. And it's fantastic. So we're working, and it's been doing really well. It's published by Renegade Games, and we're coming out with a deluxe version with about 300 cards in it, and it's really great. I'm very excited about that. It's a lot of fun, and I've got ideas for two or three more games, and I just need the time to sit down and work on them. So I've been enjoying, going just from strictly game illustration to actual game design. Well, the Kobolds Ate My Baby Munchkin expansion, I actually designed that, so that was a nice little credit there.
So how do you like designing games versus just doing art for a game someone else?
I love designing the games. I especially love designing the games because I can do that when an idea strikes me. Not being a professional game designer who's got to come up with an idea, every month or two a month or something like that, takes a lot of the pressure off. An idea will suddenly hit me. It's like, oh, that would be a fantastic game. So it's kind of more of a hobby, really. But it's been a lot of fun. It's been a very satisfying part of working in this industry.
So do you have any tips for anybody who would like to make their...
Louisa yeah. just reminded me as well. One other thing.
Sure.
This is why I bring my women along with me. They are much smarter than I am. I'm also working on some kids' books.
That's Not How Mom Does It.
Yes. I've got one book which is finished called That's Not How Mom Does It. I've got another one I'm working on. And so that's been really fun as well. Just doing these books that I can read to Louisa, and right now I'm talking with some agents, and hopefully this thing could actually see the light of day. So fingers crossed.
I'm assuming that book was inspired by Louisa.
That book was inspired by
the time that happened when Mom was away.
Yes.
He was combing my hair.
Yeah.
And then I just yelled, "That's not how Mom does it."
Yes, this is generally how ideas hit me, actually. Something like that happens, and it's like, hey, that's not bad, and I sketch it down. But yes, Judith was away for a week. I was looking after Louisa doing the solo dad thing for the first time, the full week solo dad, and just combing Louisa's hair, and she yelled out, "That's not how Mom does it." And a quick Google search was like, hey, there are no kids' books titled "That's Not How Mom Does It." That's great.
That is
how
great.
Lucky for me.
You're making Baldur the War Stormtrooper.
Yes, that was more of a secret.
Empire.
Yes.
But Mom made her own version.
Yes, yes. That one's a little bit more of a secret, honey.
We can edit that out. So do you have any tips for people who are interested in, like you did, making their passion into a career?
It's hard. It's hard for me to say because I've been very, very fortunate. I've been stupidly, ridiculously lucky. I almost literally stumbled into two once-in-a-lifetime games with Apples to Apples and Munchkin. So that's made it a ridiculously straightforward path. I think, I forget who it was. Like, there's somebody out there, a relatively famous person, who's essentially saying, don't follow your dreams. Most dreams fail. And it's like, wow, thank you, Disney villain. Yes. I mean, it's risky. It's always risky. And I was very fortunate because I had a wife, actually at the time, just a fiancé, who saw that I was miserable working at the newspaper, and she said, "Honey, just quit, and I'll support you for having a spouse with benefits, with medical." Mom did. Having a somebody who's got medical insurance is really hugely important. I mean, that's in any creative endeavor. That is like number one. There's sad stories out there. There are just too many to recount. Having somebody who believes in you is an absolute cliche, but it is very true. Because there are definitely times when you don't believe in yourself. And no matter how well things go, there's going to be that moment when you just need a support group around you. But it is so incredibly fulfilling being able to wake up every morning and go and draw and do something I love. I mean, my worst day, you know, I do a bad drawing. It's so fun. I mean, just sketching, even like grabbing a pencil in the morning and doing one of those, or doing a little note for Luisa's lunch or something like that. Don't have a safety net. When my parents were never that appalled when they knew I wanted to go into a creative field, but they did make sure I went to university for an economics degree in case things didn't work out. And luckily with economics, I could skip 2 out of 3 classes and get A's, and that let me hang out at the student newspaper office. So if you can find a college degree you can skip half of, that's a big plus.
All right, so we're going to open it up for questions from you guys. If you want to get up at the microphone.
Or just yell.
Ask anything. Yeah, you can yell too. There's not like a big crowd or anything.
By the way, if this is going out on a Geek Dad podcast, I suppose find a college class you can skip is not the best advice I could give me.
It's better than don't follow your dreams.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to at least give your dreams a chance. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, and that for me, it was actually really tough because there was a very clear moment. I was always very afraid of rejection. I mean, I still do not like rejection at all. It still hurts when it happens. And so for the longest time, for like a 10-year period, I was keeping my head down. I didn't want to send things out. I didn't want to send submissions out because I thought if it was rejected, that's it. That's my only chance. You know, I'll never get another chance to do this. And there just came a point in my life where I realized that the fear of getting to the end of my life and never even having given it a shot just really was far worse than the fear of rejection. And so at that point, having, you know, Judith say, "Oh, honey, just quit and, you know, try this," was huge.
Any questions from the audience? Nothing?
Who here plays Munchkin? Who here's won more than 2 games? Okay, that's fine. That's better than I thought. I think you've won more than I have. Oh, yes, Munchkin Loot Letter. What's that?
Then we're just not as nice as you. So.
Yeah. Oh, we used to play, oh boy. When my wife and I were dating, I tried to have her not fear gamers. So this was when... This is when Magic the Gathering was first coming out. So this would have been early 90s. And I would buy packs of Magic for Judith and packs of Magic for myself to get her to like gaming and to hang out with my gaming friends. And it worked. But she also got all the good cards. She would sit there going, "Black Lotus, is this good? And this is the beta, you know, Black Lotus. Thicket Basilisk, what does that do?" And I'm there going, "Plague Rat, Swamp, 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 Plague Rat, Skeleton, Skeleton." And she got into Magic the Gathering, and then we would start playing things like Lunch Money, which is a wonderful game by Atlas Games. Essentially, it's a schoolyard brawl. In card form. It's the illustrations are fantastically insidious, and the flavor text is wonderful. But so we would just be playing Lunch Money, just trash talking each other. I roundhouse you. I can't even remember them all. But the upshot was, not only did Judith grow to enjoy gaming, although she's never been much of a role player, because I this was my biggest mistake, was using Call of Cthulhu to introduce her to role playing. And I could have used Rocky and Bullwinkle at the time. I could have used, I don't know, anything. I could have used Dungeons and Dragons, for heaven's sakes. And I was a pretty good Call of Cthulhu game master. And this one campaign that Judith got in on, one of my veteran players ended up cowering in the fetal position on the couch. I turned all the music down, the lights down, I had creepy music playing. And what happened to you, honey?
I got turned inside out.
And?
I went crazy.
Yes, she got turned inside out and she went crazy. Which, you know, it's Call of Cthulhu, but for heaven's sakes. But yeah, that was a big mistake on my part, so she's not really role-played since then. Although I gotta say, I'm loving Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. I don't know if anybody else out there plays it, but it's just a really, really nice system anymore. So anyway, the upshot is, Judith was not scared of gamers. Judith regularly comes, she's part of our board gaming nights. She is a cutthroat player. She has got no mercy in her soul at all. And she bought her wedding dress by selling the Black Lotus.
Nice.
So you have a gaming night. How often do you guys play, weekly or?
I try to play weekly, but it's essentially two groups that swap. One is my role-playing group, and the other is a board game night. I would love to get more time for gaming in. It's really tough when you're working in the gaming. It's like one of the great ironies of working in the gaming industry is, unless you're playtesting something, you've actually got very little time to play games. So those times when I glom onto something that makes me happy, just is ridiculously fun. But yeah, this is also why most of my gaming is probably board games and, you know, Euro-style games. Because you can just have a couple of friends over, pull a game out, and have a great game in a couple of hours. I would love to have the time to play something like Arkham Horror or Talisman. I remember these great all-night games I used to have when I was in college. And those were magnificent. That's just not going to happen anymore. If it comes to miniatures gaming, at least there you can kind of leave the stuff on the table for the next session. But yeah, I try to get at least a weekly game in now, maybe a couple times if I'm lucky. But it, in a more perfect world, I would have much more time for gaming.
What game is your role-playing group playing right now?
Right now we're playing Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. Which I love. I mean, we very much enjoyed Pathfinder, but Pathfinder was not a game which I would have been able to run because it's got a lot of bells and whistles, just a lot of crunchy bits. Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition is very streamlined and it's tremendous fun. 4th Edition was not really for me. I think a lot of people felt that way. I've heard a lot of good things about it, but it just wasn't my game. So I sort of skipped over that, played more Pathfinder. We've been playing Edge of Empire in Star Wars, which I very much enjoy. I finally have got my comeuppance on my group, though, because all of the Fantasy Flight dice have got symbols on them. And being a graphic artist, it's like, you know, I've got this arcane druidic knowledge. It's like, oh yeah, you got disadvantage with that. And they're like trying to add up the various symbols, which counteract other symbols, and the like. And I've enjoyed Fiasco. I just tried Dungeon World for the first time, which is a very free-form role-playing game. That was a lot of fun. It's possibly a little too free-form for my regular play, but I think it is something I'd like to get into the rotation a lot more often. And I'm hoping to run some Call of Cthulhu again for my Thursday night group. Judith, you want to come in on a game? Again, my wife shakes her head in the back. I'm hearing maybe.
So you've mentioned Star Wars a couple of times.
Yes.
I assume you've seen the new movie.
8 or 9 times.
So does that mean you like it?
I absolutely understand everybody's criticism of the movies. I loved them. I was... Hold on a second. Yes. Yes. So, and the great thing about this, and this is going straight to the Geek Dad experience, is I've got so much invested in Star Wars, and the prequels were so gutting to me personally. I know some people love them, that's fine. I just totally found them a awful, horrible experience. It was... but I had a lot invested in this movie. But more than that, Luisa has become a Star Wars fan in the meantime. When she was 5, we went on the Star Tours ride at Disney World.
I've been Rebels 5, 5, or 6 times.
Yes.
And Dad's been it 0 times.
Yes. All my life, I've never been the Rebel Spy on the Star Tours ride. And we went on the ride about 20 times over a 4-day period. And Luisa was the Rebel Spy 5 or 6 times.
Of course.
And in fact, Matt Blum and his family came with us on one of them when she was the Rebel Spy. So anyway, after doing this, she loved it, and she wanted to see all the movies.
But we always ended up at the trash compactor part when it was my bedtime.
Yes, the trash compactor part did tend to come around her bedtime a lot.
Even at cousin's house?
Yes.
I watched it to there, and anyway... My bedtime until we finally finished
that. Yes, so we finally finished the movies, and she enjoyed them, and it actually gained a new appreciation for Return of the Jedi and the Ewoks, because just seeing the joy they brought Luisa, I always put it significantly behind A New Hope, by which I mean Star Wars, and Empire Strikes Back. And I got to, going through it again, time after time after time after time, 6-year-olds can really rewatch stuff. It's phenomenal. I did get to like it a lot more.
I just don't like the part when Han gets frozen in carbonite.
Yes. Well, worse was to come. but it made it for a very special time for the lead up to the new movie, because a new trailer would come out, and I would wait for Luisa to come home from school so we could watch it together. And that was just one of these really special dad moments that nobody warns you about. It was just fantastic. So we would watch these, and Judith and I went to see the movie the day it opened to make sure it would be okay for Luisa.
And I asked, when we were going, to the movie theater.
Yeah.
Or, when I was going home.
Yeah.
I think it was the variety show day.
Oh.
I think that was the variety show
day.
I had an act, that's why I think I went to change in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And then I asked Mama,
yep,
did anyone die? And she just nodded.
Yes. Spoiler alert. We thought that needed spoiling, so that Luisa.
I did not say the person, though.
You didn't. Although I think most people know at this point, so it's okay, honey. Yes, Jabba died.
Not Jabba.
So anyway, Judith and I went to see it the first time, the opening night, and I've got a lot of friends who work in Hollywood now, so I'd heard some rumors about some of the stuff that would happen in the movie, and I was sort of upset by that. But we get to the theater, and I've got so much invested in Star Wars at this point in time, I was literally shaking, waiting for the movie to come on. And Judith, Star Wars made me lie to my wife. Judith turns to me, and she says, "Honey, why are you shaking?" I just look over and say, "I'm cold." But yeah, it was totally. I loved it. The first time I saw it, I don't think I could enjoy it fully because I was so nervous about it. The second time, about 30 minutes into it, I realized, oh my gosh, I really love this ride. This is fantastic. I love the charisma, the chemistry between Finn and Rey and Finn and Poe. I love BB-8. I love everything about it. And yeah, I totally get the criticisms. Don't care. It's my Star Wars and it's back. It is. I loved it. I had such a great time. And mommy's. Oh, yes. Judith believes this is Chewbacca's movie. And I have to agree. It is wonderful. The little things about Chewbacca in the film are just fantastic.
Chewbacca did shoot Kylo Ren without killing him.
Spoiler alert! No, I'm kidding, honey. Yeah, so one of the most wonderful things about my life at the moment is, as you can tell, we've got a family of geeks. It's just terrific.
And my wife and I went and did a marathon on opening day. We watched all the movies leading up to the premiere. And then we took my son the next day. We wanted to see it first, too, to make sure it was okay.
Yeah.
We covered his eyes during that scene that we...
Luis actually wished to leave the theater for that scene. And actually, it's still a very hard scene for me to watch. I mean, that is my favorite character in the original trilogy.
But once on the... But...
Oh!
But just once on the... Well, I seen the part when Han died on... When we were flying to Spain, Mom was watching the new Star Wars movie. I looked over there, and I looked at the bad time when Han died.
Yes.
I looked at that, and I was like, ooh, so that's how he died.
Yeah.
Don't shout. It's Disney.
Yes. And because the First Order, much like the Empire... does not believe in contractors who put up railings on their pits. We're in the... So the first time, I'm walking Luis out around the theater trying to judge when we can go back in when it's safe. And I find myself blurting out loud in the crowded theater the second day of the showing, okay, honey, I think it's safe. I think Han's dead now. I honestly don't know if anybody heard me. I feel so bad about that. I did not even think about that. So I'm a conscientious geek. That was bad. That was very bad.
All right, last chance if anybody wants to ask anything before we wrap up.
Oh sure, now they're competing questions.
I'm just curious, do you feel that your education in economics has helped you in any way in gaming, either to handle the business side of what you do, or help you design game mechanics, or
make games? I think that, and also I've got a general science background, because when I first went into college, I was studying astrophysics. But I think those help in general, especially the mathematics part. I mean, logic and all just across the board. I mean, there's nothing can really point you specifically, but just having... And then you'll just like look at, they have in the back of your mind a general probability curve and go, oh wait, that won't work that way because that. So it's been more of a general thing. The economics certainly doesn't really help with the... economics games, you'd think it would, but true macroeconomics rarely enters into Settlers of Catan.
Can you talk about how apples to apples came about?
Oh yes, apples to apples. That we had formed out of the box as a company to produce one game. Called Bosworth. Bosworth was a wonderful game. It's a chess variant. It's a very clever chess variant. But I'd been invited to be part of this game company because the head of it, of this new company, had seen my work for Steve Jackson Games with Illuminati New World Order, which is another long story in and of itself. And I kind of felt a little bit forced, I mean pressured, into joining this company. Originally, I was just going to be the artist. Then they started doing a cash call to get money to finance it. And I totally felt a little bit pressured into ponying up some money to help this fledgling company. I did it. Looking back, if anybody were to, you know, if somebody were to come up to me and say, hey, these people want me to invest $6,000 in the chess variant, I would say, you're out of your mind. I mean, do not do that. That is a sure way to lose a lot of money. But the very first convention we went to was the Origins Gaming Convention in Columbus with Bosworth. And Bosworth was a very well-received little game. But a game designer came up to us by the name of Matt Kirby. And he said he had this game he wanted to show us called Apples and Oranges. He'd been taking this around a lot of game companies, and nobody was really interested in it. Mark and I, the two gamers in the company, both kind of went, heck no. do not want to look at this game here. Al Waller, the salesman of the company, arranged a meeting with Matt after the convention, and he laid this game out for us. It was a very large, complex game. It had a lot of Trivial Pursuit-like features, a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of different parts of this game. One small part of this game was these cards, which were very much like the Apples to Apples cards to this day. There is a set of green cards, a set of red cards. This one small aspect of the game, you get to this stage and you pull the cards out. Everybody got five cards, not seven. And the judge pulls out a green card, lays it down. Everybody else lays their card down. Judge chooses. At that point, Mark, the majority owner of Out of the Box, said, wait a second, this is the game. And almost literally every other component of this game just lifted it up, moved it to another table. And for the next hour, we're sitting there at this bar, at the big bar in Second, at Origins, playing this game. And none of us had ever seen anything like this game ever before. There had been nothing like it, and we just couldn't stop talking about it. The whole drive back to Madison from Columbus, we kept talking about this game. And Out of the Box obviously bought the game immediately. And it was a slow build, because again, it was a very different kind of game. So in the early years, we'd sell 7,000, 10,000, 15,000 copies of the game, which for, you know, a small game is not bad numbers, but every year after that, it would double in growth. And it's the kind of game where you'd get eight people playing it and four of them would go and buy their own copies. And it absolutely changed party games. I mean, up to that point, party games in the U.S. were trivia. Everything was a freaking trivia game. And, you know, trivia is fine for what it is, but it's not a game. It's a quiz. That's how I look at it. And bringing this judge mechanic into gaming, we actually had a point where we were trying to... there's a discussion, should we try and get a patent on this mechanic? And we didn't. And I'll be honest, I'm kind of glad that never happened, because I think having that judge mechanic out there in so many other games, and like some games will do just an absolute ripoff of Apples, others will take it in whole new directions, but it's just made gaming much richer. And it's really something to sit back and think that I was lucky enough to be part of a game that changed gaming. It's just, sometimes it's almost stunning. So.
All right.
Young lady, yes.
Could you tell us some things that happened and that's not how Mom tells
us? Let's save that for another, I'll bring some of those down and we can show people that, okay? I'll bring some of that art down. So from my kid's book, I'll bring that to the next panel discussion or something. We can pass that around, okay?
Okay. Well, thanks, John. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. thank you for listening to me ramble.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.